Good morning and welcome to the Monday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. Republicans want to punish students who shut down controversial speakers on campus, by Katie Riley. Republican lawmakers are wading into the intensifying debate over free speech on campus, proposing legislation in at least a half dozen states to regulate student protests and discipline hecklers. Inspired by a spate of recent demonstrations that shut down controversial conservative speakers at universities from Vermont to California, Republicans are seeking more formal punishments for students who disrupt speeches, including expulsion. All across the nation and here at home, we've seen protesters trying to silence different viewpoints, Speaker of the Wisconsin State Assembly Robin Voss, a Republican, said in a statement last week announcing the Free Speech on Campus Act. We need more speech, not less. It's time to put in appropriate measures to ensure all speech is protected at our universities. In the past few months, schools across the country have struggled to handle protests and counter-protests that derailed events featuring controversial speakers. Conservative writer Charles Murray was shouted down and then physically confronted by protesters who surrounded his car at Vermont's Middlebury College. Peaceful protests turned violent and resulted in more than $100,000 in damage at the University of California, Berkeley, forcing the cancellation of an event with far-right pundit Milo Yiannopoulos. Last week, conservative pundit Ann Coulter canceled her event at Berkeley, calling it a dark day for free speech in America after a lengthy back and forth that culminated in the Berkeley College Republicans suing the university. The proposed Wisconsin law would require students to be suspended for at least one semester or expelled if they are twice found responsible for interfering with the expressive rights of others. The bill also requires that campuses be open to all speakers who are invited and asks that universities strive to remain neutral on public policy issues. The bill, which would only apply to state universities, is similar to legislation currently under consideration in Illinois, Michigan, North Carolina, Texas, and Virginia, according to the conservative Goldwater Institute, which drafted the bill after which they're modeled. Those who support the legislation and those who oppose it all say they have the same aim, to shore up freedom of expression on campus. But their approaches differ, with liberals calling for the right to protest views they deem offensive, while conservatives say they want to protect space for unpopular ideas that spark disagreement. Jim Manley, senior attorney at the Goldwater Institute, said the goal of the proposed legislation is to prevent future speaking events from being canceled. The reaction should be, how can we challenge these ideas and present what we think is the right viewpoint, he said. It's so important for universities to be the bastions of free speech because the university is a place where you can think the unthinkable and ideas can be debated in a way that helps us seek truth, Manley added. If we put artificial guardrails on that discussion, we're all the poorer for it. Democrats in some states, though, have criticized the legislation as extreme and potentially harmful. I disagree strongly that the university needs us to tell them how to handle this, Representative Teresa Berceau, a Democrat representing Madison, Wisconsin, told the Wisconsin State Journal, calling the issue an artificial political controversy. Democratic Representative Diane Hesselbein said the bill might protect one student's right to free speech at the expense of another's. Other lawmakers said the bill is unnecessary because universities already have disciplinary policies for disorderly conduct. And in North Carolina, where a similar bill passed the House last week, some Democratic lawmakers voiced concern that if universities strive to remain neutral on public policy, it could affect their ability to research or comment on climate change. But free speech watchdog group said the proposed legislation could be a step in the right direction. I have to say, after a state legislative season where we've seen a lot of bills trying to penalize or prohibit protest, it's certainly nice to see state legislatures trying to protect speech, ACLU attorney Lee Rowland said, while adding that it will be challenging to get the balance right. She said the bills are written too broadly and don't effectively distinguish between peaceful protests and aggressive obstruction. Joe Cohn, legislative and policy director at the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, which supports civil liberties on campus, said the provisions that enforce a minimum suspension or expulsion might be too heavy-handed. But he said some sanctions are necessary when protests get out of hand. Otherwise, you foster an environment where the way you get your way or the way you stop your political adversaries is engaging in violence. Cohn, who's working with the Goldwater Institute and lawmakers on this legislation, said it's crucial to ensure that all forms of constitutionally protected speech remain protected under new laws. That means distinguishing between acts of free speech, booing or silently walking out of a lecture, and acts of censorship, which include grabbing a microphone, assaulting a speaker, or blocking the entrance to a building. When you actually prevent others from hearing a speaker, then you have infringed on free speech rights, Cohn said. And free speech means nothing if you don't also have the freedom to listen. How Batteries Could Revolutionize Renewable Energy, by Justin Warland. All over California, there's evidence of the state's goal to lead the country in renewable energy. Enormous farms of shiny solar panels have popped up across Southern California, and gigantic wind turbines dot the landscape outside nearly all the major cities. There are less flashy and less visible investments in renewables going on, too. Tucked away in warehouses, trailers, and industrial parks are lithium-ion batteries that, if all goes well, will play a critical role in helping California hit its ambitious target to have 50% of all electricity come from renewables by 2050. Some green energy sources come with a built-in challenge. The wind and the sun can't be turned on and off at will. When it's windy and sunny, an abundance of energy may be harnessed, but any excesses go to waste. That's where batteries, the most common type of energy storage, come in. Batteries solve that problem by allowing utility companies to collect excess electricity and store it for times when the sun may not be shining or the wind not blowing. Networks care about reliability, says Logan Goldie Scott, an energy storage analyst at Bloomberg New Energy Finance. Energy storage is being viewed by network operators as a potential tool in their toolbox, and that hasn't been the case up until now. In 2013, California launched an aggressive effort to ramp up large-scale energy storage with an initial goal of building 1,325 megawatts of storage by 2020, the equivalent capacity of two average-sized coal-fired power plants. Today, the state is already home to 36% of the country's battery storage capacity, with projects continuing to open on a regular basis, according to a Climate Group report. Oregon and Massachusetts have since announced their own storage targets. Meanwhile, dozens of cities have made commitments to get 100% of their electricity from renewables. California's effort will serve as a test case for policymakers and utilities across the country hoping to deploy more renewables. If it works as planned, others will likely follow suit. Everybody looks to California to see what works and what doesn't work and how to tweak it, says Marlene Matika, global renewable energy leader at Deloitte Consulting. States are looking at it in terms of renewable technologies and how to get more value out of their systems. Batteries will also change the power sector as homeowners and businesses install their own products. Batteries at homes, offices, and other commercial buildings allow customers to save electricity collected by their solar panels and use it at times when electricity prices are highest. One in four businesses with more than 250 employees has already deployed batteries to help with their electricity management, according to a Deloitte study. Regulatory changes that encourage battery owners to sell back stored electricity when it's in high demand could increase interest in batteries, analysts say. Batteries installed in electric vehicles, for instance, will also affect the electric grid as automakers continue to expand their offerings. Experts say the impact will both stress and help utilities manage their electricity supply. The stress comes as vehicles create a new demand for energy, but at the same time, batteries in those vehicles act as a storage unit of their own that may offer new flexibility. The largest battery in a Tesla, as one example, can store enough electricity to power the average American home for more than 3 days. Utilities have begun exploring programs to encourage electric vehicle owners to charge their cars when there's extra power on the grid. Perhaps the biggest open question for energy storage remains how much and where the market will grow in the coming years, whether lithium-ion batteries will keep their place as the top way of storing electricity. Hydrogen storage, molten salt, and other forms of batteries all offer alternatives that have received significant investment in recent years. But much like photovoltaic solar panels in recent years, the cost of lithium-ion batteries has already come down so much that the market's continued growth seems almost inevitable. A few years ago, batteries were seen as talked about in terms of innovative technology, says Matejka. Now it's here and it's starting to be used in full force. Thousands of immigrants to march in May Day protests across the U.S. by Amy Taxon and Steve Peoples for the Associated Press in New York. Immigrant and union groups will march in cities across the United States on Monday to mark May Day and protest against President Donald Trump's efforts to boost deportations. Tens of thousands of immigrants and their allies are expected to rally in cities such as New York, Chicago, Seattle, and Los Angeles. Demonstrations are also planned for dozens of smaller cities from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, to Portland, Oregon. In many places, activists are urging people to skip work, school, and shopping to show the importance of immigrants in American communities. While union members traditionally march on May 1st for workers' rights in countries around the world, the day has become a rallying point for immigrants in the U.S. since massive demonstrations were held on the date in 2006 against a proposed immigration enforcement bill. In recent years, immigrant rights protests shrank as groups diverged and shifted their focus on voter registration and lobbying. Larger crowds are expected to return this year as immigrant groups have joined with Muslim organizations, women's advocates, and others in their united opposition to Trump administration policies. "We have never seen such an outpouring of support since the election of Donald Trump," said Kika Matos, a spokeswoman for the Fair Immigration Reform Movement. As Trump approached his first 100 days in office, he aggressively pursued immigration enforcement, including executive orders for a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border and a ban on travelers from 6 predominantly Muslim countries. The government has arrested thousands of immigrants in the country illegally and threatened to withhold funding from jurisdictions that limit cooperation between local and federal immigration authorities. In response, local leaders have vowed to fight back, and civic participation has seen a boost, including February's Day Without Immigrants. The travel ban and sanctuary order were temporarily halted by legal challenges. In addition to rallies, immigrant rights activists in communities in Indiana, Massachusetts, Texas, and elsewhere are calling for strikes to show Americans the demand for immigrant labor and immigrants' purchasing power. "On this day, we will not go to work. We will not go to school. We will not buy anything," said Francisca Santiago, a farm worker from Homestead, Florida. Immigrant advocates said they hope their message will reach Trump, congressional lawmakers, and the public, as well as provide a sense of unity and strength to those opposed to the administration's policies. In spite of Trump's avowed crackdown on illegal immigration, many said they hoped a show of strength would help persuade politicians to rethink their plans. Tom K. Wong, a professor of political science at University of California, San Diego, said the Trump administration's focus on immigration is generating more support for immigrant rights advocates. Every pivot back to the issue of immigration gives the immigrant rights movement another opportunity to make its best pitch to the public, he said. The six biggest employers in the U.S. right now, by Jennifer Kalfas. Chances are you know someone who works at Walmart. The discount retail store employs the most people of all publicly traded American businesses, with a staggering 2.3 million workers on its payroll. It's also the second largest online retailer behind Amazon and employs several times more people than its closest competition. Kroger, a Midwestern-based grocery store chain, comes in second with 443,000 employees, and Home Depot comes in third with 406,000. Responsible for inventing the ATM and hard drive, IBM employs 380,300 people. And rounding out the top five is fast food giant McDonald's, employing 375,000 people. But, of course, these workers from these top businesses don't make up a fraction of those who work for the U.S.'s top employer, the government. A staggering 22.3 million people work for the U.S. government. But that's not just politicians or their staffs. It includes public school teachers, police officers, post office workers, and those working at your local DMV, among other government agencies. Why I Hired a Team of Part-Time Moms to Run My Business, by Monica Royer. I would love to say that I always planned to build my company with a team of part-time moms, but that wouldn't be true. After leaving my corporate job in 2010, I started Monica and Andy while staying home with my newborn daughter. I had no idea what I was doing. Taking care of a new baby was already challenging, but when I added in the complexities of launching a business, my life became full-blown chaos. I worked in the snippets of time I could steal between feedings, naps, and diaper changes. Having worked in a job where I interacted with adults on a daily basis, I found these first few months to be both amazing and isolating at the same time. By the time my child was 4 months old, spring had arrived and we were ready to head out into the world. I signed up for every mom and me class that worked with her nap schedule. Little did I know that while I was enriching her development, I was also setting the groundwork for my company's team. I discovered pretty quickly that these classes were filled with accomplished women who, like me, were in transition. They were all looking for new opportunities that would allow them to spend time with their children and utilize their skills. Essentially, they were all striving for a work-life balance, and eventually, some of these women became Monica and Andy's first employees. My company's team eventually consisted of a photographer, a visual merchandiser, a sales leader, and talented retail experts. Most of our early meetings took place at Whole Foods and on walks through Chicago's Lincoln Park Zoo. As the brand has grown, so has our team. We now employ an incredible full-time team, but we still have a lot of part-time moms. When looking to fill a position, I always look for the best candidate, but when the role doesn't call for a full-time employee, I found great success hiring part-time moms. By hiring women who have leaned back into more flexible freelance careers, I've been able to bring years of expertise to our team, but within a startup budget. Managing this kind of team, however, comes with its challenges. Balancing multiple part-time schedules is difficult. Some team members are only available Mondays and Wednesdays. Others are only available Tuesdays and Thursdays. At one point last year, we had key team members that had never met face-to-face. Eventually, I decided that once a week we needed everyone to be in the same room. It not only fostered stronger relationships, but it gave my team a global view of what was happening with the brand and has led to more comprehensive strategies and long-term planning. I feel as passionate about the team we've built as the products we make. To me, the people are a part of the package. As we grow, not every job at Monica and Andy will be flexible, but I'm incredibly proud of the strides we've made to accommodate mothers who want to work. Monica Royer is the founder of Monica and Andy, a clothing store that specializes in quality organic baby apparel. This is part three in a four-part series about how she started her company. Part four will focus on scaling and expanding your brand. Taco Bell is taking reservations for five-course dinner featuring secret menu items. Want to be one of the first to try Taco Bell's newest food creations? You may be in luck. Taco Bell is opening the doors to its test kitchen in Irvine, California, where ideas for menu items like the Doritos Locos Tacos and Naked Chicken Chalupa originated. The fast food chain is giving interested customers the opportunity to make a reservation through OpenTable for a five-course dinner that includes twists on Taco Bell favorites and never-before-seen menu items before they're made available to the public. There are only 32 spots open for the May 19th dining experience, and Taco Bell is picking up the tab. The chance to be the first to see our innovative food, where it's created, from the chefs who make it happen, is a unique experience that's never been available to the public until now, Liz Matthews, chief food officer at Taco Bell, said in a statement. But if you don't get a reservation, you're still in luck. Taco Bell said this is just the first of many dining events it will host at the test kitchen. Deadly tornado tears through Texas. By the Associated Press, Canton, Texas. Authorities in East Texas now say at least four people have been killed as a series of tornadoes pummeled parts of three counties east of Dallas. They caution that the death toll, originally put at five, could rise again as search teams go through the extensive wreckage. Canton Mayor Lou Ann Everett says multiple tornadoes that began late Saturday afternoon left heartbreaking and upsetting destruction 35 miles long and 15 miles wide. A Van Zandt County official says search teams going door to door are dealing with gas leaks and downed power lines and trees. The National Weather Service has confirmed at least three tornadoes touched down in the Canton area, about 50 miles east of Dallas. ETMC Regional Health Care System spokeswoman Rebecca Berkeley says 56 people have been treated at three area hospitals. Six remain hospitalized Sunday morning, and two of those are in critical condition. Horton asked that people who didn't need to be in the area to stay out so that our teams can do what they need to do to take care of these people who are in need. She noted that a triage center was set up at the local high school. The extent of the damage in the area wasn't immediately clear, but video from local television stations showed uprooted trees and overturned cars along rural wet roadways, along with at least two flattened homes. The tornado flipped pickup trucks at a Dodge dealership in Canton and tore through the business. At least one tornado has been confirmed so far as having touched down in Canton, though several tornadoes were reported in the area, according to National Weather Service meteorologist Mark Fox. Local resident Ernestine Cook told WFAA-TV that she rushed to a storm center just in time. "It hit so hard, so fast. It just kept moving," she said. "I've never seen anything like it after 22 years of living here." A dispatcher at the Van Zandt County Sheriff's Office said officers were chasing numerous injury reports and declined further comment. The Five Best Jokes from the White House Correspondents' Dinner by Alana Abramson. The White House Correspondents' Dinner, usually a night where celebrities, politicians, and the media team up for a night of laughter, was a different affair Saturday than in years past. In a break with precedent, President Trump not only declined to attend the dinner, where presidents typically give a satirical toast, he wasn't even in the nation's capital, choosing instead to hold a rally in Pennsylvania. And the featured speaker, Daily Show senior correspondent Hasan Minhaj, didn't hold back during his speech, joking about his Muslim background and former President Barack Obama jet skiing while the world burns, and of course roasting President Trump and his administration. "I am truly honored to be here," Minhaj said, "even though all of Hollywood pulled out now that King Joffrey is president and it feels like the red wedding in here." Minaj did close on a more serious note, emphasizing the importance of journalism and the First Amendment, telling journalists how, in a sense, they now feel the way minorities have felt for decades, and marveling that, as a Muslim American son of immigrants, he was invited to skewer the president at the annual dinner. "Only in America," he said. Here are the top five moments from his speech. Poking fun at Kellyanne Conway's use of alternative facts. "I would say it's an honor to be here, but that would be an alternative fact. It is not. No one wanted to do this, so of course it lands in the hands of an immigrant. That's how it always goes down. No one wanted this gig. No one. Don Rickles died just so you wouldn't ask him to take this gig. R.I.P. to Don Rickles, the only Donald with thick enough skin to take a joke like that. R.I.P. to the legend." Comparing the Trump administration to Anthony Weiner. "For the record, the WHCA is a group of journalists who cover the White House. They are not King Joffrey's goons. So I am so glad you guys are all here tonight to honor a great tradition. Because we all know this administration loves deleting history faster than Anthony Weiner when he hears footsteps. So thank you for being here." On Trump's absence at the WHCD. "I get it. We got to address the elephant that's not in the room. The leader of our country is not here, and that's because he lives in Moscow. It's a very long flight. It's hard for Vlad to make it. Vlad just can't make it on a Saturday. It's a Saturday. As for the other guy, I think he's in Pennsylvania because he can't take a joke. I get why Donald Trump didn't want to be roasted tonight. By the looks of him, he's been roasting nonstop for the last 70 years. Historically, the president usually performs at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, but I think I speak for all of us when I say he's done far too much bombing this month." The timing of Trump's tweets. He tweets at 3 a.m. sober. Who tweets at 3 a.m. sober? Donald Trump, because it's 10 a.m. in Russia. Those are business hours. Fact-checking Trump's Frederick Douglass remark. Frederick Douglass isn't here, and that's because he's dead. Someone tell the president. A critical history of that "It's Gonna Be May" meme by Ryza Bruner. Ultimate celebrity Justin Timberlake has spent most of his life in the public eye, maturing from a cute Mickey Mouse Club kid to a curly-haired teen heartthrob boy bander to the dapper family man he is today. But besides making trolls music, dabbling in fashion, and photobombing his wife on the red carpet, Timberlake has a claim to fame that really takes off on social media each spring as April fades away. "It's Gonna Be May" is the meme that keeps giving, and it's all thanks to the iconic voice and face of Timberlake. Back in his NSYNC days, Timberlake contributed to the 2000 smash hit song "It's Gonna Be Me." The titular line, as sung by Timberlake, is enunciated with a distinctive twang, turning the final "me" into "may." But it wasn't until 2012 that the tune took on a whole new meaning as internet users began to memeify the moment, according to database Know Your Meme. 2 years after that, the saying was popular enough that President Barack Obama and his social media team couldn't resist jumping on the bandwagon. Obama posted a picture of himself and Timberlake on Facebook on April 30th with the fateful caption. It has since racked up nearly 500,000 likes. Even Timberlake himself has been able to poke fun at the phenomenon, tweeting about the meme last year. In a radio interview, he shed some light on the backstory behind the unusual pronunciation. He was directed to say "me" as "may" thanks to legendary pop producer Max Martin, who also contributed to the writing of the song. "I think he just wanted me to sound like I was from Tennessee," Timberlake explained in his defense. For better or worse, that decision has meant that every year the song gets a bolt of fresh life just as the spring flowers are beginning to come into bloom. So prepare yourself for the oncoming rush of posts on this too-perfect pop culture topic. As April comes to a close, it's gonna be May indeed. Joe Biden heads to New Hampshire as 2020 speculation mounts by Alana Abramson. Donald Trump may only be 100 days into his presidency, but Democrats are already looking ahead to the 2020 election when they hope to win back the Oval Office. But what's still unknown is which candidates the Democratic Party will field in 2020. And former Vice President Joe Biden's visit to New Hampshire, a crucial battleground state, Sunday to headline the state Democratic Party's McIntyre-Shaheen 100 Club dinner, is causing some to speculate that he may throw his hat in the ring. This has been the case with previous high-profile visits to the state in non-election years. But longtime Biden advisor Ted Kaufman told CNN that a decision on a 2020 bid wasn't imminent. "That's a long way off," he said. "It'll be a long time before he'll have to think about that. And a lot will depend on where he is, where the country is, where the party is," Kaufman told CNN. Biden was accompanied by New Hampshire's groundbreaking all-female congressional delegation, Senators Jean Shaheen and Maggie Hassan, and Representatives Annie Custer and Carol Shea Porter. The former vice president ultimately decided against challenging Hillary Clinton in 2016, announcing in October 2015 that he decided not to enter the race because his family was still reeling from the loss of his son Beau, who had died of brain cancer several months earlier. "I believe we're out of time, the time necessary to mount a winning campaign for the nomination," he said at the time. "But while I will not be a candidate, I will not be silent." But in public remarks at Colgate University last month, Biden professed his belief that he would have beaten Trump if he had run, although he doesn't regret his decision given his son's death. "Do I regret not being president? Yes," Biden told Colgate President Brian W. Casey. "Do I regret not running for president in light of everything that was going on in my life at the time? No." If Biden were to launch a campaign in 2020, it would be his third attempt at the presidency. He previously ran unsuccessfully in 1988 and 2008 before joining Obama on the ticket to become his vice president. Donald Trump on North Korea, healthcare, and the future of his presidency, by Alana Abramson. In a wide-ranging interview, President Trump reflected on the issues that have dogged him through the first 100 days of his presidency, declining to rule out military action with North Korea and insisting pre-existing conditions would remain in the health care bill he wants to push through Congress. Sitting down with CBS News' John Dickerson, Trump said that he didn't want to discuss the missiles North Korea had been launching, the latest of which happened on Friday, only noting that he would not be happy if these actions continue. When asked if that sentiment could morph into military action, Trump responded, "I don't know. I mean, we'll see." The president did have some praise for North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, referring to him as a smart cookie. He was a young man of 26 or 27 when he took over from his father, when his father died. "He's dealing with obviously very tough people, in particular the generals and others," Trump said. Tensions between the U.S. and North Korea have increased in recent weeks as Kim Jong-un continues testing missiles. In response, the United States ordered the USS Carl Vinson aircraft carrier to the waters off the Korean Peninsula and conducted its own nuclear-capable intercontinental ballistic missile test. Last week, the Trump administration summoned the entire Senate to the White House for a briefing about this issue. Aside from his foreign policy, the president was also asked about his effort to repeal and replace Obamacare, which congressional Republicans are working on a second time. The first version of their replacement bill, the American Health Care Act, failed to make it to the House floor for a vote because it didn't have enough support. Insisting that he would not sign a bill that didn't benefit the voters who catapulted him to victory, Trump told CBS the new version of a health care bill would include coverage that didn't penalize people who had pre-existing conditions. "We've set up a pool for the pre-existing conditions so that the premiums can be allowed to fall," he said. "Pre-existing conditions are in the bill, and I mandate it. I said, has to be." Trump tweeted Sunday that a new health care plan with lower deductibles and guarantees for coverage of pre-existing conditions was on its way, but didn't specify when it would be introduced to the public. Trump's comments contradict an amendment to the American Health Care Act that House Republicans introduced earlier this week that would allow states to opt out of certain Obamacare regulations, according to a copy first obtained by Politico, which includes a ban on charging people higher premiums for pre-existing conditions. Six Science-Backed Sleep Remedies by Amanda McMillan. Sleeping pills are big business. About 1 in 25 adults has taken a prescription sleep medicine in the last month, according to data from the Centers for Disease Control. And according to Consumer Reports, Americans spent $41 billion on sleep aids and remedies in 2015, a number that's expected to reach $52 billion by 2020. But plenty of people are looking for natural solutions, too. Use of melatonin supplements, for instance, more than doubled in the United States from 2007 to 2012. And while scientific evidence for many herbal and alternative insomnia treatments is thin at best, there are some drug-free remedies that have been well studied by ongoing problem. It's important to figure out and address the underlying cause, says Dr. Daniel Barone, assistant professor of clinical neurology at Weill Cornell Medical College. In the meantime, these alternative remedies may help you get back to sleep sooner. Melatonin supplements. By far the most common thing I recommend to patients is to take melatonin, says Barone. The hormone, which is produced by the brain in preparation for sleep, is also available in pill and liquid form, which you can get at any health food store or pharmacy. Good news, because some modern behaviors can interfere with its natural production. When we're exposed to TVs, computers, and phones with backlit displays, that tricks the brain into thinking it's light out and it doesn't make as much melatonin as it should. Getting natural melatonin production back on track is the most sustainable scenario, Barone says, but taking an over-the-counter brand might do the trick short-term. Barone recommends taking between falling asleep and immediately before if you have trouble staying asleep. Valerian root. If melatonin doesn't work or patients don't want to take it, Barone suggests trying valerian root. A 2015 review published in the journal Evidence-Based Complementary and Alternative Medicine concluded that a few high-quality studies report modest benefits of valerian for insomnia patients, adding that while the overall evidence remains mixed, the safety of valerian is well established. Like all supplements, however, valerian can have side effects, and you should get clearance from your doctor before taking it, since it can interact with some drugs. The main thing to consider with all of these substances is how you feel in the morning, says Barone. Some people feel fine, but some people feel groggy and hungover. Lavender. A 2016 study published in the journal Explore found that college students who inhaled a lavender-scented patch before bed reported better nighttime sleep and more daytime energy compared to those who inhaled a placebo patch. Studies in other populations, including middle-aged women and heart disease patients, have also suggested that lavender can improve sleep quality. This may be due to lavender's relaxing effects on the body. In a 2012 study in the Journal of the Medical Association of Thailand, people who inhaled lavender oil had significant decreases in blood pressure, heart rate, and skin temperature compared to those who inhaled a base oil without lavender. Chamomile tea. It's marketed as a before-bed beverage for a reason. The herb chamomile has been used as a sleep aid for thousands of years. While good research on chamomile's effect on sleep is sparse, one 2016 study in the Journal of Advanced Nursing found that new moms who drank chamomile tea for 2 weeks reported fewer symptoms of sleep inefficiency and depression. Plus, says Barone, the feeling of sipping on a warm beverage alone may elicit relaxation and sleepiness. This type of remedy is not going to hurt, and it might help, he says, so it's certainly worth a try. Meditation. I'm a strong advocate of mindfulness and meditation for relaxation, says Barone, who recommends shutting off electronics 30 to 60 minutes before bed and sitting quietly, focusing on soft music or deep breathing. And if someone wakes up in the middle of the night, I tell them to do a 10 to 15 minute session of meditation then, too. If you're new to meditation, Barone recommends finding a mobile app, audio program, or online video to guide you through some exercises. In fact, better sleep may be a byproduct of increased mindfulness, even if it's not directly addressed in practice. In a 2015 study in JAMA Internal Medicine, adults who spent 2 hours a week learning meditation and mindfulness techniques for 6 weeks, but who never discussed sleep, reported less insomnia and fatigue than those who'd spent that time learning basic sleep hygiene. A noise machine. Research published earlier this year in the journal Scientific Reports found that listening to sounds from nature, like a rainforest soundscape or a babbling brook, can trigger a relaxation response in the brain. Soothing background sounds can also cover up man-made sounds like voices or traffic, which were shown in the study to have the opposite effect. Look for a noise machine or app with nature-inspired settings, or opt for one with a pink noise option. Another recent study, published in Frontiers in Human Neuroscience, suggests that pink noise, a mix of frequencies that sounds more natural and balanced than white noise, can also improve sleep. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.